Obamacare is on the way out, or is it? With a critical vote looming tonight on the Republicans' replacement plan, how are things lining up for Trump care? The vote puts Janesville's own Paul Ryan on the hot seat. We'll talk about what today's vote means for him, why Senator Ron Johnson is skeptical of the plan, and how all of this fared in the latest Marquette Law School poll. On the local level, City Hall is finally cracking down on bad landlords. What took so long? All of that, plus winners, losers, and viewer questions from the state's best political team, today on JS on Politics. Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and we're going to start out today in Washington, D.C., where all the action is on the health care bill, in this segment looking at how things are shaping up on that measure. We're joined now by our Washington Bureau Chief, Craig Gilbert, to talk about the big day in Washington where the health care vote is coming to a head. Craig, can you give us a quick update on where this stands? Is the vote still scheduled today? Do the Republicans feel they have the votes and so forth?
Well, nothing is sure right now. There's a mad scramble for votes. It's really complicated because the House has to decide what kind of legislation can be not only passed politically in the Senate, but can meet the Senate rules, which are kind of arcane. And so the more desperate they get, the more willing they are to kind of pass a bill that they know is not going to get through the Senate, and the Senate will have to change. But then there's this sort of push-pull with moderates and conservatives in the House, where the conservatives, the hard right, has made such demands of changes in the bill that they risked that they're going to start losing moderates and even some mainstream conservatives. So that's the vice they're in right now. And part of this is going to have to do with the ability of Donald Trump to sway some of the people in the House Freedom Caucus, which is the conservative wing of the House conference.
Yeah, so how, though, do they thread that needle, which you were just sort of referencing? Because some of the things that the most conservative members want are things that would violate Trump's campaign pledges to maintain, the pre-existing conditions and other aspects.
Right.
And then the moderates, you'll lose them and vice versa. I mean, how do you get that done and keep a bill that, or is it just pass anything today and move on?
That's why this is so hard, because threading the needle in the House is different from threading the needle in the Senate. And you can satisfy all these conservatives, maybe, and try not to lose vital moderates in the House. But then it goes to the Senate, and the center of gravity is not as far to the right. And there's no way the Senate will pass a bill probably that meets muster from the House Freedom Caucus in the House. So this is why this is proving so difficult to do. They're really isn't a consensus among congressional Republicans about what to replace Obamacare with.
So if the vote comes up today and if it fails, who do you think takes the blame? Is it Donald Trump for not doing enough, or Paul Ryan for not managing the measure to get it through? Who takes the blame?
Well, there'll be a lot of finger pointing to go around. I mean, I think probably the Paul Ryan camp could end up sort of pointing the finger at recalcitrant House conservatives. How can you, if the bill fails in the House, the charge will be, this is our one chance to repeal Obamacare, and you blew it by making the perfect the enemy of the good. People will point to Paul Ryan and his leadership, and there may be the nightmare scenario for Republicans is if the Ryan camp and the House leadership and the White House start blaming each other. I mean, it's been a pretty impressive accomplishment so far politically for Ryan to keep Donald Trump on board, because they both have a common interest in getting this thing done. But if it blows up on both of them, that's really going to test their solidarity, which really is a recent phenomenon. It wasn't there during the campaign, so there's plenty of potential for cracks in that alliance.
Yeah, so let's look very briefly at the other side. So if it passes today, who gets the credit? Or is it just a short-term credit because we still have to get it passed through
the Senate? Well, it's a provisional victory. I don't think there'll be too many victory dances yet, because everybody knows the numbers in the Senate are really daunting. I mean, there are only 52 Republicans in the Senate. There are big parts of this bill that can't survive a filibuster and have to be passed. There are parts of what they want to do in the end that they need 60 votes, but there are other parts where they may just need 50. But even then, they can't afford to lose more than two Senate Republicans. And you've got, a core of three or four Republicans on the hard right, like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who've been saying all along they don't like this. But then you've got a larger number of senators who are either moderates or more mainstream conservatives who've expressed a lot of reservations. Even Ron Johnson, who's been railing against Obamacare ever since he first campaigned for the Senate, was bracing in his criticism of the House bill a couple days ago here in Washington.
All right. And finally, let's talk about Paul Ryan in particular and what he has at stake in today's vote. You have a story that ran this morning and is available online that looks at just that. But he's talked about being the opposition party for years. Now the Republicans are the governing party. He's got to show that he can get it done, right, to herd the cats.
He does. This is all about. This is the first great test of his speakership in a period of unified Republican rule. This is like the golden opportunity all these Republicans say they've been waiting for and working toward. And if they can't deliver on the first, not only the first item in their agenda, but the item in which everything else depends, the thing they've been running on for years, but the whole rest of their agenda is constructed on the edifice of Obamacare repeal. They need the numbers, the budget cut, the tax cuts they get out of Obamacare, this Obamacare repeal bill, to make tax reform work down the road, to make their budget process work. So this blow, there's a lot of wreckage politically and also legislatively for Republicans if this goes down.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that update, Craig, and we'll have more to follow on that one as it makes its way through the system. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, stay tuned.
All right. Let's talk a little bit more about Paul Ryan and his turn on the hot seat today with Bill Glauber, one of our political reporters, Dan Bias, our Watchdog columnist. So, guys, what's your sense of how Paul Ryan is handling, which is really his first big legislative challenge, rather? He's done policy a lot before, but here's a legislative issue. How does he get this bill through?
With great difficulty. The old line about you don't want to see how sausage is made, you really don't want to see how this legislation is made. It is, quite frankly, a mess that he's trying to put together. He's sticking to his guns. He wants to get it passed today. So far, that's what we think. It's the 7th anniversary of the implementation of Obamacare. So, they have deadlines that they're trying to meet, and they're also trying to avoid, frankly, going home during the Easter recess, facing voters without anything done.
And what he passes, he needs to have the Senate accept. So he's in a very difficult position
right now. It seems right now that they're less concerned about that and more concerned about just getting something through the House.
They don't have the votes. Right. I mean, the New York Times was saying yesterday that he had 150 supporters and he needs 216. He has some people leaning that way, but they're 30 solidly opposed at this point, and they're asking... they're asking Trump and they're asking Ryan to strip things out of the bill so they can support it. But when you do that, you lose people on the other side, on the moderate side. So, in the rush,
what's getting lost is they're actually trying to make policy on a big piece of the American economy. 14 million people were going to lose their health care, I believe, within 2 years under the original bill, 24 million over 10 years. There's no scoring on whatever they're doing now. We really don't know what they're doing. It seems like they're Democrats. That was the criticism of the Democrats.
Legislators. That's what's going on.
But okay, so Republicans knew since November that they were going to be in the majority in both houses and with the presidency. Paul Ryan's a very methodical person. He plans things out. Is it surprise you that we're at this stage and there's so much at play and up in the air in terms of what the actual bill is going to be?
No, I don't think so, because the fact is everybody agreed on repeal. Nobody agreed exactly on replace with what. And so that's where it gets difficult. Everybody agreed that there were problems with Obamacare. But the problem is, what are you going to do? And you do have moderates who like things about Obamacare, including the
Medicaid coverage.
The Medicaid coverage and some of the, the 26-year-old kids being allowed to cover.
Pre-existing conditions.
All of those things are things that some people like, but the Freedom Caucus doesn't like much of anything about the Obamacare. So you're torn between those two sides in trying to put together a coalition to get this bill through.
All right, so let's assume that it does get through. And then it goes to the Senate, where there's a lot of skepticism there, too, including Ron Johnson.
Ron Johnson is basically his entire career originally was to be against Obamacare. That's what got him thrust into the U.S. Senate. He's expressing skepticism, basically saying that they have this pot of money and they're broadening who it will go to. And you can't do that, and you need to target this money, and, you know, is what he's saying, focus like a laser on improving Obamacare. And so for him to even be expressing skepticism shows you what is, you know, the chaos that's going on.
In the fall, does it surprise you, A, that he's this skeptical, and B, that he's so blunt about it? There wasn't a lot of mince words.
No. Blunt never surprises me with Ron Johnson. And the other thing that doesn't surprise me, again, he was schooled as an accountant, so he's a dollars and cents guy, and that's what he's viewing this in dollars and cents. Where is the money going to go? Is it going to be targeted in the ways that it should be targeted?
Back to your earlier question about, does it surprise us that we are where we are? You know, Paul Ryan has had his plan, and he's had it for a long time.
He's been waving it around. He waved it around at campaigns, events all over the state.
But the fact is, there wasn't any consensus on it. There's no surprise that this is what he wants. But, you know, the surprise is that he can't get any, you know, that he can't get a coalition around behind it. You know, it was something that he developed pretty much in isolation. And now that he's been, you know, forced to thrust it into the center stage and try to see if he has a majority of people behind it.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about what the public view on the Affordable Care Act is. And these are numbers we're going to show you now from the Marquette University Law School poll that came out yesterday. And so this is the options that people were asked whether to retain or and improve Obamacare, 54%, keep as is, 6%, repeal and replace, which is what Republicans ran on, 28%, and outright repeal, and apparently no replace, 8%. And let me show you one other slide here, too, on sort of the descriptions of it. So when people were asked about the Affordable Care Act, 51% found it had a favorable rating of it, but Obamacare was only 40% favorable, and of course they are exactly the same thing. So Bill, what's going on here? You wrote about the poll yesterday.
Well, first of all, Donald Trump, who puts his name on everything, planes, buildings, does not want his name on this
thing.
Want Trump Care to be known as Trump Care. Secondly, I think the Affordable...
Is it Trump Care? I mean, he's been very much on the sidelines, though.
Well, eventually whoever signs it, that's whose package it is. Right now it's Ryan Care, and then it becomes Trump Care once he signs a bill,
maybe
if they ever get
McConnell
one.
Care or something.
Or some people say Obamacare 2.0.
Yeah, so. But the... you know, the 60% who either want the thing, you know, as is, or who want it improved, I think that's fairly surprising. But there was strong support for Obamacare here compared to the rest of the country, but I didn't think that much. And it shows the sort of the fire that Republicans are playing with, trying to come up with a bill that's going to please more people.
Right. It's when you give a benefit to people, I mean, it's a lot harder to take it away once you've done that. And, you know, nationally, there has been a shift from those who opposed Obamacare to now where there is a slight support. But the support here is stronger than it is nationally. The numbers I've seen nationally are 47%, 48%.
Since the Republicans ran so hard, though, on repeal and replace, do you think they can accept an Obamacare 2.0 or a refine and improve plan rather than repeal and replace?
Well, I don't know what you end up with if you don't have anything, but I think they have to push ahead with repeal and replace.
And it's quite possible that at the end of the day, the insurance markets are going to be in worse shape after all of this happens than even before Obamacare. We really don't know.
One interesting thing about the Obamacare versus Affordable Care Act is you have to remember, Obama is popular here. His numbers are generally in the 53-54% favorable line. So it's actually not Obama that's unpopular, it's Obamacare that's unpopular.
You know, also what I've found interesting in the past week or so, Scott Walker no longer says about what's going on about Obamacare, that, it only affects a few people, most of people it doesn't affect. I think he's come to realize that, it's going to affect a lot of people.
All right, well, let's look at the favorability numbers for Donald Trump and Paul Ryan, who are the key players in this debate. And this is, again, from the Marquette University Law School poll. So Donald Trump's approval rating was 41%, 47% disapprove. Paul Ryan was approved 45% and disapproved 38%. So it's probably not surprising that Paul Ryan's a little more popular here than Donald Trump. But what did you guys make of the numbers?
Well, Trump has gained some ground here. The last time they did this poll, he was in the low to mid 30s.
And that was on a favorability rating. It wasn't a job approval.
Well, which is generally similar, but his numbers are up. And what the pollster Charles Franklin said is, what we've seen is Republicans have now come to side with Trump, whereas they were pretty evenly split back last year.
I think nothing has changed. I think at the end of the day, the state is where it is, where it always is, and through all the hue and cry of the campaign and, you know, the torches against the establishment, the state is right where it normally is, which is about 45% of people like Scott Walker, about 45% of people don't like the guy. Not many people, you know, a minority like Donald Trump, but it's a minority enough. And the, Paul Ryan's favorability ratings are still fairly high. Much has changed.
I do think things have changed. What has changed is last year there were people in the suburban Milwaukee counties who were not happy with Donald Trump as the nominee. Eventually they've come around, but there was a long stretch of time last year where they were not happy. There were his support in the WOW counties was down in the 70s at certain points last year. Now it's finally come around. So I think it's been a slow process. They didn't like him, but now he's the one they have, and they finally they've decided to side with him.
Let's come around to another set of numbers here. These are for our two U.S. senators, and here we had Ron Johnson at an approval rating of 39%. Disapproval of 34%, and Democrat Tammy Baldwin, who's up in 2018, has approved 40%, disapprove 35%. So what do you make of those numbers? I was a little surprised that Johnson, who won re-election, right? So there was, in the run-up to the election, we kept talking about, well, no one knows who Ron Johnson is. Then everybody voted on him. And apparently,
and at that time, there was 21% who said that they didn't, but now it's back up to 26%.
I think it shows you, I mean, about a quarter of the population doesn't know either person. And I think that what this points to is the irrelevancy of the U.S. Senate in terms of there are a few giants there. And I think that this is probably not just here in Wisconsin, but elsewhere. Basically, people who know them kind of like both of them. But the fact that one out of four registered voters don't have enough of an opinion to form on them, I think it's not their problem. It's the problem that the U.S. Senate has just been a wasteland for many years.
It is Tammy Baldwin's problem, since she's running for election in a year and a half and she's at 40%. She's in the same position that Ron Johnson was a couple of years ago. She's going to face a tough race next year.
And they both are in that dynamic of in their first term, so their first re-election, and she'll be running in a year when Scott Walker's on the ballot, in the same way Ron Johnson was running in a presidential year, so that
and gets them, but gets maybe the winds maybe come back a little bit towards the Democrats. That normally is what happens in the off-year election. The out party gets some gains, but she's going to have a tough time. There are probably half a dozen Republicans who are all credible, serious candidates, taking a look at the race, any one of whom would be a very serious challenge to Baldwin.
She has picked up a little ground. The last time the poll was done, it was even. Her negatives and positives were even, and now she has a 5-point bump.
I think it's pretty soft, though. I think that you'd have to say it's soft.
Yeah. No, I think she's in this exact same position Ron Johnson was in.
Let me ask who you guys are watching in terms of the potential Republican opponents. You have had a couple, you know, Sean Duffy, for instance, said he's not running, but who's the one that everybody's waiting to decide before they make their move?
Well, I think that the one with the most money is Eric Hovde, even though he ran before, finished second in the primary against Tommy Thompson the first time Tammy Baldwin ran. He's not remained very visible, but he still has a lot of money, and he can buy that sort of name recognition.
Leah Vukmir is making noise. Like
she's
wants
making the rounds in Washington.
Rounds.
Yeah, she's been in Washington the past week, you know, meeting with lots of people. I think it's pretty clear that she wants to run.
Dale Koyenga is making a move. Mm-hmm. Kevin Nicholson, who nobody outside of politics has heard of, is sort of trying to present himself maybe as the fresh-faced guy, a businessman and U.S. Marine, former U.S. Marine. So there's a lot of good options for them. And of course, Fitzgerald, leader of the Senate, is taking a look at the race.
And Sheriff Clark has changed his position from I'm not interested to maybe, I don't say no, I never say no, but I'm less than 50-50 in terms of interested in this race.
All right, so we'll watch and see if that's 50% rises or falls in the coming weeks. But let's take a shift here now to an issue of more local interest and importance on what the City Hall has been doing on absentee landlords and problem landlords in the city.
We're joined now by Mary Spicuzzo, who covers City Hall and politics for us, Carrie Spivak, who's one of our watchdog reporters. And Carrie, you've been writing a lot this year and last year about bad landlords and some of the games and shenanigans they play to avoid paying taxes and fines. Can you give us a quick update on where some of those stories stand?
Well, the most recent thing is that Jim Herrick, who is the executive Robert W. Baird and lives in a $1.1 million mansion out in River Hills, we found out last year that he owned numerous Central City properties that were loaded with problems. The mayor was pretty upset when he found out about that, and he put some pressure onto Baird, and Mr. Herrick has since sold seven of his properties for about $1.6 million, which is a little bit less than he paid when he first purchased
them. Right, and he had some pressure, I presume, from Baird as well to get out of the landlord business.
Baird made it clear they were not happy with the publicity he was generating and that he was in that business.
Yeah, and he has this, is this all of his properties, or are there more to sell?
There's still a couple more properties that LLCs that he's connected to own that have had some problems. So far, we're getting no feedback as to whether he's being pressured to sell those or if he's going to sell those, so we're still waiting.
And Mary, let me ask you, so at City Hall, the stories that Carrie and Kevin Crow wrote last year generated a lot of attention, you know, task force, calls for action. What's happening on that front?
Yeah, common council members got very concerned about this after the series ran, or as the series has been running. They immediately, after the start of the year, decided to do essentially a task force to crack down on problem landlords and LLCs who try to use this veil of secrecy. It passed unanimously. One person was gone, but 14-0 on the common council floor. They were fired up and ready to go, and then 2 months later, that committee has not met. There was a debate over an agenda that apparently led to a canceled meeting. They kind of fought about whether it was outside the scope of this committee that had been originally focused on foreclosed and abandoned homes. So they've now basically, created a new task force with different membership to go after this issue. They seem to be over the hurdle, but again, 2 months has passed and they haven't.
Yeah, how quickly do you expect this group to work? Because it seems like it's like a meeting in order to have a meeting, in order to schedule the agenda, in order to have the meeting. But when will the new... When do you think we'll see some recommendations and things coming forward?
Well, the goal, they're supposed to have something done by the end of June. We'll see if they meet that deadline. But they wanted to come up with a list of actions that they were going to take and things that they wanted to see done. They said that they wanted accountability. They wanted to make sure that this another committee that's meeting to address this is meeting it. There are a lot of committees at City Hall. But, I think that this is something that got under Common Council members' skin. Obviously, a lot of these, they have...
They're in their district.
Right, exactly. Cases, yeah. And they are sometimes, magnets for crime, drug dealing, other issues, and they would like to see them cleaned up.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, so there's some things the city can do on its own in terms of getting tougher or pursuing different collection avenues. There's some things that they can't do. So, Carrie, tell us about some of the measures at the state that we could see introduced and moved.
Sure. City Hall and Representative Goyke have been working on legislation. They're trying to bring in some Republican sponsorship also, and sounds like they will have that. Legislation would make it easier to buy properties at sheriff sales, which is where you can buy foreclosed properties for next to nothing. They want to be able to put that on the internet. And they also want to ban anybody who owes any city money for court judgments, building code violations, or back taxes, prevent them from buying properties at the sheriff sales.
All right. Well, that'll be things to watch in the weeks and months ahead, and I'm sure there'll be more task force meetings on committees on task forces at both levels of government, probably.
There have been some more lawsuits, too, so there has been action. To be action. Fair, the city attorney's true. Office has taken some legal action.
Yeah, they've gone after a couple of the bigger players.
Yeah. All right.
So maybe
all
more
right.
of those, too.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, so let's stick with local issues for a little bit here. Dan, this week there's been a little more back and forth with Sheriff Clark and Mayor Tom Barrett and their ongoing long
And they've been going at it for a long time.
Probably since they went to Marquette High School together.
I think it really ramped up when they went on CNN and had a debate on gun control. And this week Barrett criticized the sheriff for being missing in action, saying that he's not around at all, that he was fighting crime from one conservative talk show to another, and that he rode his horse out of town a long time ago. But what caught a lot of people by surprise was Clark's response. And he's always critical of the mayor, but he went after him for how he handled this incident at State Fair Park back in 2009, where the mayor heard a woman shouting, asking for help. He went over, and there was a drunk guy with a tire iron who did a lot of damage, messed up the mayor's hand, knocked out a tooth, a number of other things. And the sheriff said, you know, that shows what he knows about crime fighting. He had his butt kicked by this guy, and that he should
always a good look for a law enforcement person to mock a crime victim.
And essentially, that's what he did. He was mocking the mayor for what happened in this case, where he was trying to come to the aid of a 55-year-old woman and her granddaughter. And, you know, when I write about these things, they're frequently 50-50 in terms of people who like Clark, people who don't like Clark. But this time, it's not even close. It's like 90 to 10 or 95 to 5. A number of people saying, I don't like the mayor, but you shouldn't be making fun of him for trying to intervene in a situation and help someone in dire straits, as happened in this case.
All right. Well, let's shift now to our winners and losers from the past week. And, Bill, we're going to go to you first.
An easy one, Wisconsin Badgers. They dethroned defending champion Villanova. They made the round of 16, the Sweet 16, in the NCAA tournament, bringing some good times to people here in Wisconsin. Always good to see them do well.
Do they win Friday?
I don't know. I really don't. I mean, you know,
you're wearing your Gators.
I'm wearing orange. It's Thursday. You're wearing orange.
I really don't know. I mean, it's the NCAA's. Yeah. Anything can happen. It's at Madison Square Garden, so it should be a great theatrical event.
Well, it's an interesting region because Duke lost too, so it's a little clearer path for the Badgers to make it. Dan, you're a winner from last week.
One thing that we didn't talk about on the Marquette poll is people's views on public schools, and in this era where we talk a lot about school choice and charter schools, still 3 in 4 people in Wisconsin say they like how their schools are being operated, and 80% of the respondents say they want more money being put into schools.
All right, and you're a loser of the week, Dan.
Reince Priebus.
Who? Where is he?
Reince, he just bought a house in Virginia. Do you see that? 7,000 square feet, $1.25 million. But what I'm focusing on is this week, James Comey, the FBI director, said, yes, we do, in fact, have an FBI investigation into the connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Well, if you look back a month ago, you see Reince Priebus on TV saying there is no such investigation and that he had been authorized by the Intelligence Committee to say that these stories were bogus. One is telling the truth and one is not, and I think we have a clear picture as to who that person is.
All right, and Bill, you're loser.
This is easy, Congress. It's really, they're looking bad with the way this health care bill is being rammed through. A bill that nobody is really terribly happy with. The Gorsuch nomination could be under a filibuster by Senate Democrats, who are still angry that their guy, Merrick Garland, didn't get a hearing a year ago. And then, this House Intelligence Committee, with the chairman of the thing seemingly looking like he wants to blow up an investigation of what they should be investigating, which is the Trump campaign's alleged ties or dealing with Russian during the campaign. So very, very, very bad week for Congress.
All right. Well, let's slip in a couple questions here if we can get to them. This one is from Bob in Bayside, and we'll try to, these both need a little deciphering. But his question is, my question is about Trump care. Why is it that many of the Republican elected officials speak their voice and their minds on their own, but Democratic elected officials are lemmings and follow the self-appointed monarchy? So my question is, why do the Democrats act like lemmings? Dan?
The fact is, neither side act like lemmings. Back when they were passing this bill originally, it took months and months and months to get the Democrats all together because you had Democrats who disagreed on what sort of health care. There are people who support universal health care, some people who liked what was closer to the Obamacare model. It's the Republicans are in control, and it's their responsibility to try to get the changes passed. That's what's going on.
It seems like they act more like cats than lemmings, right?
I think that's probably the perfect word. You're trying to herd cats, and you can't do it. And everybody's got an ego, and everybody has a point of view that they all want to be acknowledged.
All right. Well, I think that's all we're going to have time for today.
Darn it.
It was a very newsy week. We'll be back next week at the same time, and hope you join us then. Thank you.